This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
That's kind of one of the great effects that wolves bring to the landscape. They make the wilderness more wild. You know, they have such a beneficial effect on the entire environment and ecosystem that everything gets a little bit more of what it should be, what it's trying to be when wolves are there.
Today's show starts off in Zambia. Worldwide, an estimated 1.5 billion people don't have access to electricity. In Zambia, more than 80% of the population has no access to electricity, according to the World Bank. It's been shown that providing access to power can be tremendously beneficial to people's education, their health, and their livelihood. Our first guest on Sea Change Radio this week is Mara Haynes, who describes what her relatively small nonprofit is doing to try to change this big problem, harnessing solar power in sun-drenched areas like sub-Saharan Africa. Next, we come back to California, where after 80 years of extinction, a lone wolf has appeared in the Golden State. Author Joe Donnelly recounts the tale of California's lone wolf who wandered in from Oregon and unwittingly raised a controversy between environmental groups who want to protect the possible resurgence of wolves in California and ranchers and others who don't. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mara Haynes. She's the co-founder of Empowered by Light, which is a Bay Area-based nonprofit which aims to improve lives and communities using renewable energy technologies. Mara, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. It's a pleasure being here.
So first tell us the vision of Empowered by Light, what you guys do and what you're planning to do.
Sure. We started Empowered by Light about 2.5 years ago. It was my husband and myself and another friend and colleague. We're all very passionate about renewable energy. We try to integrate it into our own personal lives. And my husband was looking at taking a sabbatical and thought, let's try to incorporate our interest and expertise around solar to try to improve lives somewhere in the world where that could be utilized. And in that first year, there were two trips to the western province of Zambia, where we delivered solar-powered LED lights into the area there that's completely off-grid. It's extremely rural.
And explain why that's so important.
So these children, they rely on the daylight hours, the sun hours, in order to walk to school, to study at night, to cook, etc. For the most part, where we distributed those solar-powered LED lanterns, their individual units, they don't have any kerosene, so pretty much when the sun goes down, and it obviously varies on the time of the year, that is the end of their day. They have no means to do anything else.
What about candlelight?
They don't really rely on candles there. Some people that have money will have kerosene lights, but that does cost money. And so I think what the team found is that really they were just in darkness, or they would have a campfire, for example, you know, in some of these villages. So we initially thought we would distribute the lights to individual families so that parents could charge their cell phones, which is how they do any sort of business there in western Zambia and in many parts of rural Africa. They use it for all of their banking, purchasing anything. It's all done through transactions over your mobile phone, unlike here in the U.S. So at first we thought we would distribute the lights to individual families, but we were quickly told by our partner on the ground there, Zeke, it's the Zambezi Environmental Education Center that's been running for about 15 years there. They partnered with us to help us with logistics, but they also helped us understand the culture and that you can't simply give lights to some people and not others. They won't understand the value. They won't understand how to use it. They might just strip them down. or just turn around and sell them for the, you know, for what is the perceived monetary value. So instead, we delivered them to the schools, which are basically just one-room huts. They have no light, so they're just, the school is happening during the, you know, daylight hours. But by having the lights at these schools, children are able to go home in the afternoon, help with the chores, eat dinner with their families, and then come back and study as well as the light starts to fade. So these villages are clustered around the schools. So we did it with the hope of improving children's academic performance. And the data that we've been able to get out of that area, that district where we deployed, has been really, really promising.
And explain the technology a little bit more, these LED solar-powered lights, about their relative price point, and how long the lights last, et cetera.
Sure. So it's kind of looks like an Apple-esque sort of product. It's just like a round globe. Comes in white or black. It's plastic. It has three different light levels for levels of brightness. It has a 3-meter cable. It's attached to a solar panel. So it's really designed for rural parts of Africa. You put the solar panel on the top of your thatched roof of your hut, and then the cord hangs down and the light can hang. It also has a base, so you can put it on a table. But for the most part, it's meant to be hung. And then it, you know, distributes light for anywhere from 3 to 5 people to work underneath or study underneath. It provides that much light. So that's what we did the first 2 years of the project, were to distribute these lights. And then this year, we did a bunch of fundraising last year for our big project this year, which was to take an entire high school that more than 600 students attend. They had been running off of 3 old polluting, and I mean both air polluting, water polluting, and also noise polluting, diesel generators. It was costing them about $25,000 a year in diesel. And we put in a 24 kilowatt solar array with battery storage. So now that campus is powered 100% with renewable energy. It's quiet, it's clean, it's much more predictable than their diesel fuel deliveries. So that was the kind of our project. First 2 years was the lantern distribution. This year was actually taking a very large school, it's about 27 buildings, and putting them on solar, moving them off of diesel.
Well, just getting back to the lantern for a second. So does the solar panel itself cost more than the actual LED light? And how much do these cost your organization?
They're about $20 for that particular lantern.
With the solar panel?
Right, with the solar panel. Yeah, it's a small solar panel. I should know the exact measurement, but I don't. Maybe, 8 by 8 inches square.
So like a notebook size.
Yeah, notebook size, exactly. So it's very portable, although we are, as we move forward, looking at other manufacturers to find something that's even smaller. As you probably are aware, solar technology is just changing daily. So now on the market, there are solar lights that are much, much more compact. They'd be easier to ship, easier to distribute. So there'd be a lot of cost savings inherent in that.
And the lights themselves, how long is their life expectancy?
Right. So life expectancy with the lanterns is about 5 to 8 years.
I imagine they're getting a lot more use than
exactly. A lot of it depends on how you use it, how you charge it. You also have to remember it's rural Zambia. It's very hot. It's very dusty. There will be periods where it's extremely wet, and we can't say how well these will be handled or protected. You know, they are designed for Africa and for rural Africa, but there are a lot of unknown variables that will play into that.
And how many units have you distributed so far?
We've distributed over 1,500 units, which affects about 8,000 school children.
All in Zambia?
Yes, all in the western province of Zambia. The actual district that we covered is called the Shangombo District. There's about 52 basic schools, and then this one high school that I mentioned, where children walk for days actually to get there, and then they stay there, similar to a boarding school.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founder of Empowered by Light. It's a Bay Area-based nonprofit, Mara Haynes. Mara, I know that your project, this lantern project, has only been in place for a couple of years, but you had mentioned how you were trying to put in thresholds for seeing improvement in education. Have there been any reports back and any signs of improving academics within the schools that you're providing light to?
Absolutely. With the basic schools, with the they have annual exams that are given. It's for the whole country, countrywide. And with those annual exams, we've seen significant jumps in improvement for the schools that we distributed lights to. You know, in some cases, it's just the actual attendance. In others, it's the improvement in the exam, in the grades themselves. So one school jumping more than seven places in ranking for the country. So those types of improvements that we're seeing and that we hope to continue to see as we distribute more and more lights and have regular follow-up with those schools.
So the solar project that replaced these diesel generators in many of these villages, what lessons has your organization learned and how will you move forward? Are you going to be doing more of these kind of projects, and has it been a success?
Sure. So it was actually, it's just one village, and the focus wasn't actually on the village, it was on the actual high school. As I'd mentioned, there's over 600 students that attend the school. Some walk for days to get there. Some live in the nearby village, but others walk for days because there's only the one high school serving the entire district that has 52 basic schools. So they had been running off the three diesel generators, which then we replaced with the 24-kilowatt solar array plus the battery storage. And so we're really hoping this is going to serve as a showcase, not just to the people and the government of Zambia, but hopefully to all of Africa and perhaps even broader, that really in developing countries like Zambia, there is no reason why, you know, these towns and communities and a country as a whole can't literally leapfrog decades of fossil fuel infrastructure development by going straight to renewable energy technology. So this Sioma High School happened to have already been on diesel, but there's no reason that we couldn't target another school in a community area, in a village area, and put in a solar-powered microgrid and have the same thing where that community maybe did not rely on diesel. They relied on nothing, or maybe they had kerosene or candles or just campfires, and they will go straight to renewable, and they will literally never have to enter the whole fossil fuel arena.
The co-founder of Empowered by Light, Mara Haynes. Mara, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Go on your way with a cloudless blue sky above. May all your days be a wonderful song of love. Open your arms and sing of all the hidden hopes you've ever treasured, and live out your life in peace. Where shall I look for the love to replace you? Someone to light up my life.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Joe Donnelly. Joe, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be here, Alex.
You recently wrote a piece for Orion Magazine called Lone Wolf. Why don't you first walk us through the thought process in pursuing this last remaining wolf in California?
Sure. And I should just mention that it wasn't the last remaining wolf in California. It's actually the first wild wolf to come into California in more than eight decades. It entered into California late December 2011, and the last recorded wolf in California had been exterminated in 1924, ironically very close to where this wolf, whose scientific designation is OR7, ironically where this wolf ended up kind of making a home for a little while. The last gray wolf in California was exterminated in Lassen County in 1924, and this wolf started making a bit of a territory around Lassen and Plumas and Tehama and Trinity counties, through much of 2012. And I can't even remember where, but I think it might have been in the LA Times, but I saw, a short little piece about this wild gray wolf coming into California and or getting near to California. It was actually moving from the very northeastern corner of Oregon in Wallowa County, all the way to approaching the border of California. And I thought, wow, how exciting if actually this, amazing symbol of wild nature enters into California and, metaphorically into my backyard, into the very sort of seat of civilization on the West Coast, and sort of reclaim some of the wildness that, I feel like we've lost touch with over the years.
And it's designated as OR7. I assume that it came from Oregon, and now there's this fight over whether it should get a new moniker like CA1. Why don't you walk us through some of the controversy surrounding protecting this wolf?
Well, OR7 refers to, this was the seventh gray wolf tagged in Oregon, collared in Oregon, I should say. And, he spent, as I said, most of the year in 2012 and into the spring of 2013 in California. But in March of this year, he actually crossed back over into southern Oregon. So, I don't think he's quite earned his California moniker yet. But he very well may come back into California this winter. Seems like he's establishing one of the largest single wolf territories, on record, or that anyone could probably think of. And that territory very well may expand from, northern California into southern Oregon. As far as protections go, all gray wolves used to be protected federally. They were on the endangered species list, but that designation was lifted in May of 2011, a controversial decision to lift federal protections for gray wolves, especially since many people think that their recovery, which started in the mid-1990s, an extraordinary federal action to reintroduce gray wolves into Yellowstone Park in Wyoming and Montana. That program brought gray wolves back from, being almost completely exterminated or vacant from the landscape to having a healthy population in those areas. But certainly nothing even close to what their historic numbers have been. And since the feds lifted protections in 2011, management has been returned to states in the Northern Rockies, Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. And they've had hunting seasons for the last couple of years. And unfortunately, the numbers of gray wolves have gone down from, around 2,000 to around 1,000, and the trend isn't encouraging. Wolves are still protected in Oregon. They have both they have state protections there, and it's still a matter of a matter of policy and legal debate whether federal protections extend to very new wolf territories like Oregon and Washington State, and even possibly California. It seems like the feds want to get out of the wolf business and return it to states. But, California, this OR7 coming into California did have the really cool effect of putting the decisions or planning of whether to protect wolves in California in front of the game commissioners and the wildlife commissioners. And they have taken the first step they did last fall in saying that, this petition to protect wolves in California does warrant consideration, and they should be coming to a conclusion about whether to offer wolves state protection in California very soon. So, I certainly hope they go forward with that, even though there may only be at times one wolf in California.
And can you lay out the arguments from the lobbies that are for
getting rid of the wolves, the hunting lobbies and the cattle industry I'm thinking of in particular?
Sure. You know, wolves, I think, have always been at the center of, going back historically to when we started eradicating them, at the center of a land use issue battle. And, they compete for use of the land with, many of the forces of, they did at that time with many of the forces of, manifest destiny, which, would be ranching. Mineral extraction, railroading, logging, all that kind of stuff. Wolves were kind of inconvenient for those folks. And those are still basically the arguments. The cattle industry says, wolves are prey on their cattle and their sheep and, force them to bear too much of a cost. And it's, nothing in statistics would seem to warrant that. Wolves are somewhere down the list behind, way behind dogs, domestic dogs, and I think behind, birds of prey in terms of their effect on livestock industries. And let me get to the other side. The hunting lobby as well also is, full of fear and misinformation about what wolves actually do to, deer and elk herds. Since wolves were reintroduced into the Northern Rockies, in all but a handful of game management districts throughout Wyoming and Montana and Idaho, the ungulate populations have actually thrived. What they're doing is they're making deer and elk better deer and elk, which means they're not as easy for hunters to get to. That's wolves kind of have an effect of making the environment and the wilderness better versions of it, of what it should be. That's kind of what they do there. But I think that what the wolf symbolizes is to a large extent is what ranchers and hunters might think of as interference from, fuzzy, soft liberals on the coasts or in the cities, interfering with their ways of life. There's a lot of entitlement that comes with that from my point of view. There's a lot of entitlement that comes with that perspective. A lot of grazing, a great deal of grazing in the West, particularly, occurs on public lands that we all, subsidize and support. And, also, when you look into agriculture subsidies, and particularly and ranching subsidies, they're pretty significant. So we're all actually helping ranching and agriculture in the West, and by sharing public lands that are supposed to be for everyone with those actually private and special interests. And I don't think it's too much to ask to actually share the land with some of its earliest inhabitants, which would be wolves and bears and wildlife.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author Joe Donnelly. So, Joe, this fear of wolves, it's not rational, but why do so many of us fear wolves? Does it all just stem from Little Red Riding Hood or something?
Yeah, I'm not, and I don't know what the mythology of wolves is something that is really interesting and also almost impossible to come to any conclusions about. I mean, wolves are the villains in and the heroes and probably in equal parts in mythology and literature and throughout throughout time. So I don't exactly know why they're such a source of fascination. I mean, I have my own theories, but they would be just as much dime store pop psychology as anything else. I mean, I think there's something about the fact that wolves remind us so much of our domesticated partners, dogs, yet they're kind of defiant and insouciant and won't heed our call, and you know, they're wild. So they seem a little bit maybe perhaps uncomfortable and sort of like an aberration to us. They probably are both too close to us and yet completely unattainable to us. And I think that might have something to do with it. I mean, wolves are, you know, they are the Lord, they've been called the lords of nature. They're the kings of the wild in a lot of ways. And yet they also look like they are, you know, our best friends. They look like man's best friend in a lot of ways. And there's something a little unnerving about that, I think, for humans. We can't quite get our heads around that.
What is your takeaway after your experience when writing this piece, Joe? Are you more hopeful for future wolf populations in North America, or is it looking grim?
Well, I want to be hopeful, it's kind of like the human story, one step forward, two steps back. The story of the reintroduction of gray wolves to the Northern Rockies is a remarkable story full of heroes, really. If you want to look at what government can do and do well, an argument for good government in my mind is the reintroduction of these gray wolves into the Northern Rockies. Just an amazing story full of amazingly competent and dedicated people. And, you know, unfortunately, politics has sort of entered in the situation, and the federal protections have been lifted. And now we're kind of back to the sort of lesser angels of human nature and the hunting seasons that have been opened up wherever wolves are. And it's, you know, to me, it's a tragedy. We're actually tearing families apart. Wolves have close-knit, highly developed social structures and extended families, and these hunts just rip them apart. It's brutal. I'm not happy that the losses in wolf population throughout the Northern Rockies and into the West, where they're expanding into and reclaiming historical territory. I'm not happy that those numbers have been cut in half in a couple of years. But, you know, wolves are very resilient. They're very resilient animals, and I'm hopeful that there's enough of them left that they can continue to prosper. However, I got to temper that with the knowledge that at one point there was, you know, by most accounts, at least 500,000 wolves in the continental U.S. at least. And, by 1930s, there was, you know, only a handful of wolf refugees on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and, you know, in Minnesota and a couple in Montana. So, you know, men are capable of exterminating anything. We pretty much demonstrated that. So I hope that isn't the case. I hope we're learning our lessons. And, we have a long way to go to try and salvage and what's left of our the earth and what's left of nature. And while if there are wolves around, that's a hopeful sign that we're at least still in the game there.
Well, it's a terrific piece, and folks can check it out in the latest issue of Orion Magazine, and we'll link to that at seachangeradio.com. Joe Donnelly, thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Freddie Hubbard, Sinatra and Joe Beam, and Los Lobos. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.